of the Cosmoses Podcast, hosted by Justin Moses.
Welcome indeed. This is the Cosmoses Podcast, episode number 27, and features an interview with Greg Cahill of the band Special Consensus, or Special C, if you will. I'll be getting to that interview in just a moment, but I want to let you know that today's episode is brought to you by Low Vintage Company, located in downtown Burlington, North Carolina. They have high-quality instruments and accessories from name brands that you know and love. Find your timeless tone at lowvintage.com. That is lowevintage.com. Or you can call them at area code 336-524-6250. You can find them online, like their Facebook page, follow them on Instagram and Twitter. Let them know that you appreciate them sponsoring the Cosmoses Podcast. I do want to let you know, if you listen to this episode today, basically the release day, which is Tuesday, August the 16th. If you're listening today, I'm playing tomorrow in Lexington, South Carolina. And that's the only date I'm going to mention this week. Just go to justinmoses.com and check out the schedule for the upcoming dates. And be sure and join me somewhere down the road. And if you don't mind, share this podcast on your Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, anything that you have, share this podcast on it. And of course, as always, if you've not already, subscribe on iTunes, if you don't mind, and leave us a rating and review. It helps out a bunch. And requires very little effort on your part, so I appreciate all of those things. And I'm going to just today get right into the interview. Greg's been in the business for a good long time now, and we talk about that in the interview. We talk about a lot of his bio and everything, so I'm not going to belabor the point. I'm just going to get to it. Here's the interview with Greg Cahill.
I'll start out by saying I always ask people to write in with ideas for the show and people they want to hear, and somebody just wrote in recently asking for you, so it's a good thing that we got together on this.
How about that? Well, that's really nice.
Yeah, and for the listeners, I'll let everybody know that you interviewed me last Wednesday for Banjo Newsletter, and so it's a weekly thing now.
Yeah, right. We'll just have to have our Wednesday morning coffee hour here.
Yeah. So, man, tell me how you got started in the music business.
Well, you know, I'm from Chicago. I was born in the city, actually, and my family was pretty musical, but not in any way, shape, or form bluegrass musical. My mom was a great like honky tonk piano player, and my dad, you know, sang in the church choir and what have you. So we grew up with a lot of family gatherings around the piano, you know, at the end of the holiday, and everybody singing and having a good old time. But actually, when I was about five, my grandfather was a really good harmonica player. He worked for Railway Express, and so when he'd have time on his hands, he'd play the harmonica, and every year he'd give me his old harmonica. My grandmother would give him a new one, and I'd sit there and just, he'd show me tunes, you know, and I could never quite get it the way he had it, and I didn't find out till years later that it's because usually by the time he would give me the old one, at least one of the reeds was blown out, so.
Yeah.
You know, but I started playing. I lived on the south side of Chicago, so I started playing the accordion. That was a thing back in the, this is, you know, back in the actually 50s, late 50s. So I played the accordion for about 8 years, and that's how I learned how to read music And, you know, I played, it was interesting, the stuff that you learned back then. It was either polkas or classical tunes. You know, I really enjoyed playing, but I was looking for something else. Had I known, and, you know, it was about a year or two after I kind of left the accordion and got an acoustic guitar that I found out about, like Art Van Dam and all the things you could really do on the accordion that weren't necessarily, you know, and I didn't, it's not that I didn't like the polka stuff or the classical, but I just, I don't know. I kind of got into the folk music craze back this was in the 60s.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Chicago was like a mecca for folk music, you know, and all the big folks came through here. You know, Joan Baez back then, Pete Seeger, the Old Town School of Folk Music featured a lot of the folk players, Big Bill Brunzi, all sorts of really great, great musicians. And so I got into the Pete Seeger thing, and at my high school graduation, this guy showed up with a five-string band. We had a picnic, you know, big picnic, and he's playing the five-string, and I thought, man, that is really cool. And back then it was all Kingston Trio and Peter, Paul and Mary, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So I had an acoustic guitar and I got an old from Sears and Roebuck catalog. I got a five string banjo and just started thumping around on it and really liked it. And eventually I went to college, and when I was in college, I got the long neck because I was a huge Pete Seeger fan. And I even bought a 12-string guitar, had a 12-string for a while. And, you know, my folks, when they just loved music. And so oftentimes as a kid, when I'd be going to bed to sleep, they had on like Dixieland music. So I kind of went to sleep hearing like Eddie Peabody, you know, like great Dixieland tenor players. And so I think that's how the sort of the penchant for the banjo or whatever was in my head, you know, a long time ago, even though I didn't really act on that or realize that until much later. I was in college, but I got the five string. I was in a folk group with another guy and a woman. You know, we'd like play Shakey's Pizza Parlors for our spending money. And, but it was, again, it was, you know, Peter, Paul, Mary and Kingston Trio and the Limelighter, stuff like that. And then, of course, that Beverly Hillbilly show came on, and there you go. I was like, holy cow, listen to that. And then one Saturday morning, that's how the guy I was in the folk group, P.K. Frawley, that's how we met, really. He heard me sitting in a dorm room on the third floor trying to play the Ballad of Jed Clampett.
Oh, yeah.
And I was stumbling around, and he came in and he said, hey, you got to hear this. And he put it on the turntable, and I about flipped out. It was the Foggy Mountain Banjo album, you know. And,
uh-huh.
How many guys are playing that banjo? How's he doing that?
Right,
so,
right.
So that was the start of it. And but after then, I got out of college and I went into the Army for a couple of years. So I really didn't start really getting serious about trying to play the five string till I was like 27 years old.
Wow!
Came back to Chicago and there was a guy here named Richard Hood. Who was with a band called the Greater Chicago Bluegrass Band, and he eventually moved out east, and I think he was with several of the bands out there, several of the known bands, and he's still out there. I haven't talked to him in a long time, but he was a great player, and you know, I took a couple lessons from him, and then just sat down and started slowing down the records from 33 to 16, and tried to learn note by note, you know, see what Scruggs was doing. And Richard took me to the first bluegrass festival I went to was Livonia, Georgia. And we just drove all night from Chicago and went down there. And it was just, boy, that really clinched it for me. You know, I was addicted. Yeah, I couldn't get enough of it. You hear all these great bands. And, you know, I saw Bill Monroe right away, you know, and Country Gentlemen. And I think Ralph Stanley was there. And it was just... it was mind-boggling to see all those guys. Don Reno, you know, I was like, oh, my gosh. So that was the start of it for me. I just couldn't get enough, you know. That was in the early 70s and just started playing. And then went to the University of Chicago. It has a folk festival every year. It's very well. It's probably at least 50 years now they've been doing that. And they would get the real deal, you know, people from the hills and the old black blues artists and the string bands, and I mean, they just they had the Stanley Brothers, and they had Bill Monroe at one point, and they had the Pinnacle Boys, and you know, just Olabel Reed, and I met up with some guys going to that show in the hallway. And we stood there and played. It must have been 5 or 6 hours without. We were just all, wow, this is great, and became good friends. And so it was about probably late 1973. We decided we ought to do this, and you know, we got together on Saturdays in a basement apartment in near the university and played tunes together. And then of course, you know, you have some friends who say, well, come and play at our party, and this is really cool. And then eventually we started looking at clubs and so on. And that was really, we had, I don't know, several different band names, just kind of goofy things. The Cook County Doodah Boys, and just kind of having fun, you know. But that was really kind of the start of Special C.
Yeah.
And that would be probably late 73 and into 74. And by about mid 74, the bass player Mark Edelstein and I decided, you know, let's just do this for a couple of years. We were just eating up with it, you know, and it was hard to go to work because I was in graduate school. Actually, I finished my master's degree in social work and was working for a nonprofit organization, which means you spend a lot of hours, you know, it's not just a 40-hour week job. And I was married and had a son and trying to play music, and I'd fall asleep in the chair at about 2:30 in the morning, still trying to learn some banjo tune, you know, and
yeah.
have to get up at about 6:30 or 7 and get ready to go to work. It was killing me. Mm-hmm. So I'd saved up some money, and he and I decided, well, we'll just give it a try for a couple of years. So we found some guys who were willing to travel, and that was 75 when we really decided that we were going to try to make the Special Consensus just travel and go to the festivals and just play as much as we could.
Yeah, and so and Special Consensus has been a band ever since then, and you've been in it the whole time.
Yeah, I guess I never dreamed I'd end up doing it for a living forever. I mean, well, we truly had the plan of, we'll just do this a couple years, we'll get it out of our system, you know,
right.
Go back to the real world and just, you know, then play around town here. At that time, there were a lot of clubs in Chicago it was really, there was a street called Lincoln Avenue, and actually the Old Town School of Folk Music today has they have three buildings, and two of them are up on North Lincoln Avenue, a little north of where all this happened. But there was one section there where it was really so cool. I mean, you could go down there and park your car and walk maybe six blocks, and every other door was a music club. And I'm not kidding. I mean,
you
could hear blues, and you could hear bluegrass and country and rock and roll and Celtic. Just one club after another, and it was the heyday, I think, of the club scene in Chicago. And then there was a club a little further north of that on the same street, Lincoln Avenue, called the Clearwater Saloon, that started featuring just bluegrass every night. And people would come in and, I mean, wrap around the block waiting to get in. You know, two people would leave, they let two more in. It was packed out, because that was before they had any of the real club activity out in the suburbs. So people would drive into the city, you know, especially on the weekend. And it would just pack out. And there was a club called the Earl of Old Town, a little just north of on the north end of the city of Chicago. And that's where all the stars of folk music played. I was so lucky. I was living in Evanston, Illinois, about 3.5 blocks from Jethro Burns. So I'd see him all the time, you know, and learn so much about music and the business and people just being around him. And we got to play at the Earl of Old Town once a month for quite a while with him. You know, that was the double bill. We'd open for him.
Yeah.
And that was just great. And then the Holstein brothers opened a club called Holstein's, and all the bluegrass bands would you know, the touring bands would come through there and play there. And it was a pretty active scene. We'd play like six nights a week, you know. I mean, we were scraping by. You weren't making a whole lot of money, but it was good. And then we started traveling, and again, we didn't make a whole lot of money, but we found a way to pay the rent and stay solvent. And then, you know, there was always that Mark, the bass player, stayed with me. Maybe we were business partners, for about 7 years. Uh-huh. And then he decided he wanted to go to school for pre-med school. And he ended up going and getting his master's in business instead, and has worked in all different ways, different businesses and markets and what have you. And he's right back to playing music. He just couldn't stand it. So after about 20 years of bouncing around playing part-time, he just finished a run with the Million Dollar Quartet show. He was with that for several years here in Chicago. And every year, you know, it's, you get that one gig and it's like, oh man, you know, this is a great gig. This is going to really open doors for us, you know? So we'll just do that next year, you know, and then it's really going to be okay. And then it was always one more year. Okay. We'll just do one more year, you know?
Yeah.
All of a sudden, my father had his own CPA. He was a CPA and had his own business, you know, and he'd do my income tax. And it was like, at the end of the year, he said, how can you do this? You're hardly making any money. And I said, well, you know, we're getting by. And one more year, Dad, one more year, you know, because we got this other gig, you know.
Yeah.
So, and all of a sudden, it's 10 years and 15. And it's like, oh, my gosh, I'm probably unemployable in any other way now. It's no turning back now, you know.
Right. Well, the band's had a lot of members through the years, and it's been a good a lot of good musicians have come through the band. And talk about who the original members were, first of all, and then just some of the other people that have come through the years.
Yeah. The first real configuration, when we were the guys, you know, just kind of knocking around playing, there were about six or seven of us. We had a guy who, Gene Haldeman, who was a really good harmonica player, but he's also a drummer, and he was playing snares with us sometimes, and we had a guy playing electric guitar, and acoustic guitar player was Jim Iberg, and a fiddler named Jim Hale. Mandolin player Jeremy Raven, who had been friends with Eddie Adcock and knew him well, and he was a really good mandolin player, still is. And Mark Edelstein and myself. Mark played bass and I played banjo. But the core group then became that Jim Iberg on guitar, Jim Hale on fiddle, and Mark on bass, and me on banjo, and Jeremy on mandolin. But those guys all either had day jobs or were in graduate school and just didn't feel like they could travel that much. And I mean, they loved the music, but I don't think they were eating up with it. Mark and I were just absolutely. Mark had actually played blues harmonica with Hound Dog Taylor around here. And so he was, you know, really established in the music community, but he just wanted to play string bass in a string band. So he and I got a guy named Ed Walsh to play guitar and Mark Weiss to play mandolin. And that was the core group in 1975 that started touring. And we made our first recording here in Chicago on a label called Tin Ear Records. We weren't too happy about that name, but the guy approached us and said, I have a new studio, come on in and we'll do this and work out the money. And so I got Bob Hoban to produce it. Bob Hoban had toured with Vassar forever, playing keyboard and fiddle with him, and knew all the bluegrass folks around. He was at the first bluegrass festival, and he was sort of like our guru who knew what was what and helped us in the studio the first time around. And so that record came out in 1979, and that was the first band recording. And then after that, we had a great guitar player from Louisiana, Mitch Corbin, fabulous player who was with us for about a year and a half, 2 years maybe. He had met this really good singer, this woman who was a great singer and really pretty and really a sweetheart, and she would come out and hear us when we played a few hours from Chicago down in Peoria, Illinois. And he was just smitten with her and loved playing, and had some friends down there. Bob Applegate and Company was the name of their band. And he decided he wanted to move down there. And I remember he bought her the coolest pair of blue cowboy boots to go down there at Christmas time. And he moved down there. And her name was Susie Boggess. She'd sit in and sing with them and so on before she became the Susie Boggess, you know. And
yeah.
Mitch stayed down there for a while and then moved to Florida and has played, toured forever. He toured with Norman. Byron Berline really wanted him in his band. But he ended up in Florida playing at Disney World and plays mandolin, builds instruments now. I think he and Mark O'Connor for a long time were the only guys. After he left us, he went to we had played the Winfield Festival, and he went and competed and was, I think, the second guy after Mark O'Connor to win both the mandolin and the guitar contest the same year.
Oh, wow.
Anyway, and then this guy, I put one ad only once in the whole history of the band that I run an ad in Bluegrass Unlimited saying we were looking for a guitar player. I got a response, and this guy was living in Suffern, New York, and was every summer would take the train out to see his dad. His parents were divorced. He'd go see his dad out in New Mexico. And he answered and said, "Hey, I'm interested." And we talked about it, and he was coming through Chicago and had a layover of about 6 or 8 hours between trains. He took the train.
Uh-huh.
So I went and picked him up. We were doing school programs that day up north of the city. So we did a couple in the morning, and I zoomed down the Union Station, picked him up, zoomed back up north so he could kind of see what we were doing in the schools. And then we played just 2 or 3 songs with him, and he sang. And even Mitch, the guitar, he said, "Oh, man, there's the guy right there. No question about that." And that was Chris Jones.
Yeah.
So Chris then ended up moving to Chicago, and he was in the band. He was in the band about almost 4 years, and then he went and played for a summer with Dave Evans. Uh-huh. And then he came back for, I think, another year and a half or so. And then we got the mandolin player, Mark, left, and we got this young guy right out of college who had been calling me saying, "Hey, I'm coming back up there, and I'm going to be back, and I'd sure like to play in the band," and all that. And that was Paul Kramer. So he came in, and Chris was in, and a great musician from around here, John Rice, who played all the instruments, really. But he played electric bass with us and some fiddle. Mm-hmm. So the four of us, Chris Jones, Paul Kramer, John Rice, and I, were the guys on the second Special C recording called Blue Northerns. And that would be about – Chris joined in around 1980, 81, and that came out probably in 81, I think. And it was – in the same studio here in Chicago, but we convinced the guy that the Tin Ear Records just didn't sound too good, you know. So he started a second label called Acoustic Revival, and that's the label that recording was on. And then over the years, I think we had another configuration. Tim Wilson, my good buddy from down Onyxus, moved up. All the folks would move to Chicago until probably the mid-90s. That was the thing, you know, if you were playing in a touring band, usually the norm was you'd move to the city where the band was based and leave out from there, you know. So Tim moved up, and a bass player from around here, Scotty Salek, and myself, and a guy named Dennis White, who had been with the Bluegrass Alliance down in Kentucky. And he was from North Carolina, but he moved here. And so we had the third configuration, and we released a recording called Freight Train Boogie. And that came out, I don't know when that was, maybe 85 or 86. I think the Blue Northerns was maybe, I should know this, but I'm in the ballpark. But that one came out, and that was Chris and John. I mean, I'm sorry. That was Tim and Scott and Dennis and myself. And then by probably 87, 88, we got a guy named Robbie Foulkes who came into the band, and he's just a great songwriter and a fabulous guitar player, not necessarily straight bluegrass style playing, but great musician, is now extremely successful in the Americana world. So he was our guitar player, and Tim and Scotty, and then Scotty left, and we got Dallas Wayne, who had been playing. He was from Missouri, but was playing in a country house band here in Chicago. And the only guy I ever saw when he joined the band, he played electric bass, and he would take solos. He put on banjo finger picks, you know, like the exact, you know, two fingers and a thumb. Mm-hmm. And he would play solos on the electric bass like that, like almost like banjo rolls. But I mean, the bass was tuned like a bass, and it was pretty cool. But he really wanted to go back, and I always really loved the acoustic sound, you know. So he went back to the acoustic bass and played. He was with us for quite a few years, actually. And let's see. Well, first Robbie and Tim Wilson and Scott Salek and I did a recording called A Hole in My Heart. That was on the Freight Train Boogie album, and The Hole in My Heart were now on the Turquoise Records label. Because when we recorded the Freight Train Boogie recording, Glenn Duncan came in and played some fiddle on it. And he said, "Hey, I know about this new label. Why don't I just take this to her?" That was Pat Martin. And he took that to her. And so we signed up with Turquoise Records for a few recordings. And so 89 is when A Hole in My Heart came out. And that was our last vinyl recording. And then a couple years later, by now, Dallas was in the band, and a guy named Marty Maroney came in on guitar, and he was actually from around Chicago here. He's now up in Minnesota playing in a band called the High 48. But he played guitar, and Dallas, you know, was still on bass, and Tim on mandolin. And Al Murphy then was the first full-time fiddle player we had, and he came in and played fiddle with us when Tim left, and we recorded a recording called Hey Y'all, and that was our first CD cassette release. I think all of the other recordings were vinyl and cassette. We didn't do 8-tracks, so contrary to what some of the guys on stage say about my age, we were not 8-tracking it yet. So we did that Hey Y'all, and we did a tour of Finland where Chip Covington put this thing together. We were the full band. He wanted Rhonda to come over by herself in Dudley Canal, but Rhonda wanted to bring her whole family. So that was the family band back then. So they all came, and us and Dudley Canal. And, man, I'll tell you, there were some great players over there. I mean, really good musicians. And who would go to school, and over there you would get a grant to actually go to school and study music. So that was pretty cool. And so while we were over there, Dallas Wayne, you know, was with us, and these guys came up to him and said, you know, "We have great musicians. Country music is huge. We need a real country singer, and that would be you." So he stayed with us. He went over, you know, we would keep a week open in the schedule, and he'd go over there and play some shows. And finally, they really made him a serious offer. So he moved over there and ended up living, he and his wife, living in Helsinki for about 6 or 7 years, and toured as Dallas Wayne in the Dim Lights. He didn't care for the name totally, but they already had that name, so the Dim Lights, you know. So anyway, and he became a huge country star over there. He was the A&R guy for the record label and so on. But has since moved back here and still does shows on his own. And he's one of the main Sirius XM DJs now on the Outlaw Country and a station. And he programs the Willie Nelson show and what have you. So he's doing well. And then after that, let's see, what was the next recording? I think it was Green Rolling Hills. That's when we brought in Darren Wilcox on bass, who was from Wichita, Kansas, great singer. Marty Maroney was still playing guitar. And we got a guy from around here, Drew Carson, playing mandolin. And, we did a recording called Green Rolling Hills. on a Turquoise label. Marty Maroney stayed in the band for about 7 years, 7.5 years, I think, till he moved away to Minnesota. And after Green Rolling Hills, let me think, we had a, who was in the band? Who replaced Marty? I should have all this. Wait, I'm going to look here. I know I have it. I have a stack of stuff. I'm going to find it. We did a thing called Roads and Rails. That's what we did. And that was self-produced, and we were in between record labels then. We were working it out to be on the Pinecastle label at the time, mm-hmm. and we had already recorded this. And they signed us but said because of their release schedule, it would be a year before they could release it. Yeah, so I said, well, shoot, I would rather than have the thing sit in the can for a year, we'll just self-release that and then do another one, you know, when we start with them. So I did this one called Roads and Rails. I started my own little record label called Chi-Town Records, spelled S-H-Y, town, you know, because Chicago's called Chi-Town, C-H-I, Chi-Town.
Right.
I thought that was so cool. What a nerd. But anyway, and that was still the same guys. That was Marty and Drew and Darren and myself. So then we were on the Pinecastle label after that. And brought in Bobby Burns and Diana Phillips. They were married, and they came up from Texas. I had met them down in Texas. And they were in the band with a guy from around here, Colby Maddox, who played mandolin with us. And we did a recording called Strong Enough to Bend. And that was our first recording on the Pinecastle label. I can't remember the exact year, early 90s. No, it had to be later than that because Marty and them were in the mid-90s.
Yeah, you know, the first time I saw the band was you played in my hometown in Madisonville at the college there, Hiawassee College, and I think that was the band. Maybe Roy Curry was playing guitar on that show, if I'm not mistaken.
He might have filled in. I knew Roy because Roy and Bobby were great friends.
Right.
I met Roy. Yeah, that could very well be. Wow, I didn't realize that. I'll be darned.
Yeah. And so that recording you just mentioned was the first one I heard of the band, and that was probably late 90s or something like that.
Yeah, and that was we recorded that one at Brent Truitt's, and yeah. Mark Schatz produced that one. So that was our first venture with Brent. And I stayed there for many recordings, actually, after that. And they were, let's see, when they left the band, Colby stayed with me, and we got a guy from around here, Chris Waltz, to play guitar, and Andrea Roberts played the bass. And we had a great time with that configuration, Andrea. And that was when we really started. I mean, Bobby and Diana had moved up to Indiana to be in the band. But Andrea was the first Special C member to not live here. She had been down in Nashville, and she commuted from Nashville. Uh-huh. And so we released a recording called Our Little Town. And again, on the Pinecastle label, we did it at Brent's. And that was 98. So Strong Enough to Bend must have been 96, I guess.
All right.
And that was real successful. I mean, we got a lot of good airplay on that in 98. I will say, I'll do a sidebar here. I have a great friend here and great musician, Don Steernberg, who's a phenomenal mandolin player. And I think you know Don, right?
Yeah, I've met him. Sierra knows him. And, speaks highly of him, yeah.
He was kind of the protege of Jethro. And started by taking lessons from him, and then ended up playing with Jethro really throughout most of the beginning of Don's career was playing with Jethro, as well as his own band and other bands, but just a great jazz player and a lover of bluegrass music and a great bluegrass player as well. He was actually a special C-boy in everything but the banjo over the years he's filled in. And he was a special C-boy for a while as the mando player, but he's played bass with us. He's played guitar with us. And we're still great friends. We came out with a recording called Blue Skies. Mm-hmm. That was on the Turquoise label back in 92. So that was all instrumental. Half was kind of bluegrass and half swingy kind of stuff, you know, because he was such a great jazz player. And I was influenced by Jethro, influenced greatly, because, as I said, my mom had played that honky-tonk style piano, and then hearing Jethro and these old standards, and so Don and I would sit and play those, and we decided, let's just go make a recording. I don't know. We did, but we had a great time doing it. So back to Special C in 98, that's when Our Little Town came out on the Pinecastle label. And then in 99, Don and I went back into the studio, which is 8 years later after the Blue Skies, and we did one called Night Skies, where, again, we kept kind of the same format, but this time Don sang on it. He's also a great singer. And we did, bluegrass songs and swing songs, and we got Tommy Boyd to come in and sing some tenor, play a little dobro, and Sam Bush played some fiddle on it, and Glenn Duncan, again, played some fiddle. So we had a great old time on that, and that was, again, done at Brent Truitt's. So now, after Chris Waltz left the band, after Andrea left the band, we got a guy named Timmy Dishman to come, and he was playing with a band around here. These young guys, had a band. I can't remember the name of the band, but they were really good. They were young guys, and it was Tim and Noam Pekelny and occasionally Michael Cleveland. And they were all like kids back then, you know.
Yeah.
So we got Timmy to come in and replace Andrea, and got this young guy from Kentucky named Josh Williams. I remember Andrea's the one who said, "You got to hear this guy." And I thought he was a banjo player, which he was. And I met him when he was like 9 playing banjo, you know.
Uh-huh.
I had no idea he played mandolin like that. And he had just released a recording with his band down there in Kentucky. And the day he came in, his dad and he drove up from Benton, Kentucky, where he was living, and in high school. And I remember distinctly because we just played a few tunes in the living room, and of course, he played great. It was like, okay, let's see if we can work this out. And we worked it out that he could play, like, I think it was a weekend a month for a few months. This was in January, right in the beginning of January. And he was going to graduate in April. So once he graduated in April, it was fine for him to go on the road full time.
Uh-huh.
So we worked it out for him to do it. So while we were there in the living room, Andrea got a call, and her mom had taken ill. And her mom lived only a couple hours from where I live, because I'm about 45 minutes away from the Indiana border. Her mom was living in Indiana.
Uh-huh.
So she had to leave, and we were supposed to play that night. Don Sternberg was going to play mandolin. And so I said to Josh, "Hey, you wouldn't play bass by any chance, would you?" And he said, "Not really, but a little bit."
Yeah.
Well, sure enough, we went. I convinced him to play, and Tony, his dad, was great. They were just going to stay overnight instead of driving back. And of course, he played the whole night playing bass, having heard maybe not even half the material, and nailed it, you know, on the bass.
Yeah.
That was Josh's first gig with Special C, was as the bass player at a little club in Indiana. So anyway. And so then, let's see, I think the next recording was one called The 25th Anniversary, which would have been in 2000. And that was Chris Waltz still on guitar and Timmy Dish on bass and Josh on mandolin. And we did, I think we did like a dozen songs that we were playing together. And then we added another 8 songs from previous out-of-print recordings.
Uh-huh.
for that 25th anniversary, and that was on Pine Castle Records, and that came out in 2000. So then Josh hung around for a while, but got the call from Rhonda, and that was a no-brainer. And he was like, he had just told me the night before, I think I'll stay around another year. This is great and all that. And we were good buds. You know, by that time, he'd been in the band 4 years, four and a half.
Oh, yeah.
And he was struggling because he's such a nice guy. Oh, geez, I don't know. I don't want to leave you. And I said, man, this is crazy. You got to do that. You got to talk to Rhonda, you know.
Yeah.
So he did, and I got Justin Carbone came in to play guitar. And when Josh left, actually, Ron Spears. No, we had the Route 10 band. That's right. We had the Route 10 band. I'm missing that one. And that's when we got Jamie Clifton, who had from Oklahoma, and he had been in the band called New Tradition with Danny Roberts and and Brandon Rickman and all that. And so it was Josh and Timmy Dish and Jamie and I, and we did a recording called Route 10, and that was real successful for the band, and that was a really prominent band in the specialty history. And still gets airplay from that. And that was also on the Pine Castle label.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Josh left, we got Ron Spears. He and I have been buds for a long time. He still lived in Salt Lake City, but we'd see each other at festivals all the time. And he had started his band, Ron Spears, and Within Tradition, and was kind of bouncing around. And I said, man, we need somebody. Why don't you do it? So he came, and he never moved to Chicago. He commuted from Salt Lake City and then eventually moved to Nashville, where he lives now, jolting up there. But so he was in the band, and then we got Justin Carbone came in and replaced Jamie Clifton on guitar, and Trey Nugent replaced Timmy Dish on bass after a few years here. And we did a recording called Everything's All Right, which is a song that Justin co-authored. And let's see, I'm thinking about when that came out. That would have been probably 2000. Let's see, we were up to, sorry, I do, sometimes it's hard to remember the exact years.
Oh, definitely.
It piles up, but Route 10 was probably 2002, so this was probably 04. That Everything's All Right came out. And, you know, that we had a great time doing that one. And in the middle of doing that recording, Trey left, and we got David Thomas came in to play bass. And he was from Alabama. He's an Alabama boy, and he commuted from Alabama to Nashville. We'd meet in Nashville, and Justin lived in Nashville, and then so did Trey live around there. And then David eventually moved to Nashville, and Ron eventually moved to Nashville. So the three of them were down in Nashville. I was the only odd man out here up in Chicago. So I would just fly down and meet up. You know, we kept our band vehicle down there and what have you. And we came out with a recording then, David and Ron and Justin and myself, called The Trail of Aching Hearts. And I'm trying to think of the date on that. I'll get the date on some of these here as we go along, I promise.
That's all right.
That was 07. That's what that was. Yeah. And that was still on Pine Castle. And then I think the next one we came out with would have been our 35 recording. Oh, no, we came out with another. No, I'm sorry. After Ron left the band, we got Ashby Frank came into the band, and he was with us. And we had a great time with old Ashby. And we did a recording called Signs for Pine Castle, and that was a song that Ashby had written. And so that came out on Pine Castle. That must have been 09, I guess. And that was our last one on Pine Castle.
Mm-hmm.
And then they kind of faded away, as you know, kind of overnight there. And
right.
They're back now, good as ever. But they faded away, and we came out. We had one in the can that was about to come out in 2010 called 35 to celebrate our 35th anniversary in 2010. Yeah. And that was, David was still playing bass, and Ryan Roberts, who was a great songwriter and singer and guitar player from Canada, who kind of moved to Nashville for a while playing guitar. And then Rick Ferris, who I had known since he was a kid with the Ferris family, he was their guitar player, and I needed a mandolin player, so I called him up. And Ron at that time had gone with Doyle for a little bit. Rick was like, yeah, but I don't play the mandolin. I said, yeah, but you play the dobro, you play a little banjo, you play the guitar, you play the guitar really well, and you play the bass. You could do it. He's like, oh, man. Well, because I loved his singing, you know.
Right.
And I knew he was a good picker. So I said, I'll give you a month. You got a month. Just try to learn some songs and come on, you know, you can do this. You'd be great. Just try it. He said, well, all right, I'm going to give it a try. I'm going to work on it. But I'll tell you what, if I think I stink, I'm not coming. So then I knew, you know, if he had that attitude, I knew he was going to be good. And he was. He came to Chicago, and he doesn't live here, didn't live here. But, I mean, he came up. We played together. He played great. I think he played two shows with us and went right in the studio and recorded the 35 recording. And when Pinecastle kind of went out overnight, I was good friends with Allison Brown, you know, and I called her up and said, Allison, oh, geez, I got this thing in the can, and it's the 35th anniversary, and, geez, I really want it to come out in 2010, this year, and you think we could convince you to sign us up, even just for one record, you know? Blah,
blah, blah. Yeah.
And she was great, she and Gary. We had a couple meetings, and they said, yeah, come on, bring it on, you know? And so we cut back the list. We had a bunch of songs we were going to put on there. We cut it back and put 12 songs. Six of them were by us, the band at the time, and six again from previous recordings that were out of print. Mm-hmm. And that was our first Compass Records release in 2010 called 35.
Yep.
So then by 2012, we still had David in the band. And we still had Rick in the band, and Ryan Roberts moved back to Canada, wanted to go back there with his family. And so we got Dustin Benson to come in and play guitar. And when I signed with Compass, Allison had said, hey, I'd really like you to record in our studio. I had recorded a bunch of these recordings with Brent Truitt, you know, we were good buds. And he had great ears, and I said, well, I've been working with Brent, you know. And she said, well, I know, and there's nothing. And he's great, but we have this studio right here in our building. It would be good if you recorded here. And I said, okay, how about if I convince you to produce? If you produce us and we record there, then one and one is three, right? So she said, okay, I'll do it. So she produced our first recording that we did in the Compass studio. That was Scratch Gravel Road, and that came out pretty okay because that was nominated for the Bluegrass, the Best Bluegrass Album Grammy that year.
So
we were all very happy about that.
Yeah, and that was the first Grammy nomination the band had gotten?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yep. That was the first any big thing like that we had. So we thought we had a good team, you know?
Right.
And so then that was 2012, 2014. You know, it's like every other year we go in. And I'd had a friend, Rick Spratt, who had been bugging me for years saying, you know, I'm telling you, John Denver material would sound great done bluegrass style, and you'd cross market and it'd be great. I was like, I wasn't crazy about doing any kind of tribute thing, you know. And But after the Grammy nomination for Scratch Gravel Road, it was like, man, how do you follow that now? What do you do? So I thought, well, if there was ever a time to try it, now's the time. So we decided we'd do a tribute to John Denver, and that became Country Boy, a bluegrass tribute to John Denver. But that was, you know, right around the what was it, the 40th anniversary of the Circle album? 40th or 50th? I can't remember. So we thought, well, let's just, Alice and I talked about it a lot, so let's just do a mini version of that. for this John Denver thing, and bringing a bunch of friends in Nashville. So we got a slew of folks to come in and sing and play, and just had a great old time, and did the John Denver songs. And sure enough, the one we did with Rick and Claire Lynch singing Wild Montana Skies won the what was recorded event of the year for IBMA. And then we did an instrumental. We couldn't decide, you know, John Denver didn't really write instrumentals, so we took one of his most popular songs that sounded like it would make a cool fiddle tune, and that was Thank God I'm a Country Boy. one of John's big hits that was not written by him, you know, a friend of his. So we got Michael Cleveland and Buddy Spiker to play twin fiddles, and Allison. We had sort of started a thing. I'd written a tune for Scratch Gravel Road called Jack Lean, which is – that's another story. I play on my wife's name, Jacqueline. But so Allison – I asked Allison to play a twin banjo part with me on that, and she said, oh, yeah, okay, sure. So we did that. So now we had this sort of – thing going. So when we did Thank God I'm a Country Boy with the twin fiddles, I said, well, come on, let's play a twin banjo solo on that one too. And so we worked it up note for note, and we did. We had a great time. And so that then won the instrumental recorded event of the year from IBMA the same year. So once again, we were really happy, you know, that we just enjoy. Allison's just such a great producer, you know. She's just got wonderful, just great ears and great ideas and great arrangement ideas. And we just sit around a table and talk about how are we going to do this song or what about that song. And then it ends up, you know, we come up with an arrangement. And we used to really prepare a lot going into the studio. But now when we went in for this Long I Ride, our newest one, which just came out, it was like, well, let's just go in and see what we can come up with, because everything would come out so drastically different, you know. We were thinking, well, now we got the arrangement. But so we went in with Long I Ride and you know, added a few guests. We did we had the theme now, because 2015 was the 40-year anniversary of Special C, which still floors me, you know. I can't believe that it's been 40 years. We had a big concert at the Old Town School of Folk Music and brought back at least 25 of the alums who had appeared on some of the recordings, you know, and did songs from each recording with at least two or three of the guys who had been on the recording. And so the theme for Long I Ride was kind of that, you know, being around for a while. And Long I Ride is actually a song that Robbie Foulkes wrote. So, and we put a song that Justin and Ron co-wrote called Time for Moving On, and we did Highway 40 Blues, but got Della May, our friends Della May, to come in and kind of like the older band and the newer band, and did that, like two bands doing their version together of that song. And so we tried to choose the material that sort of related to having been around a little while, and it's been doing real well for us. We're real happy. So so that in a nutshell, but a big nut. I did at one point go over, you know, we go to Europe quite often, and since 1993 we've been going to Ireland and England and sometimes Scotland every other year. And at one point we were scheduled to go right before the Iraqi war broke out, and that's when the Route 10 band was around, Josh and Jamie and Tim. And so I had this tour booked and called the agent and was trying to cancel. I said, you know, the guys are just, you know, concerned about leaving the country, you know, when we know that war is going to break out the week that we head over there. And they weren't worried anything had happened, but it was like, what if they start closing borders or something, you know?
Yeah, right.
And I called the promoter, and he said, no. He called me back and said, one of the promoters for the festival, which is the Buhl Fest now in Germany, he said, this is the first time we're bringing over an American band. You're the headline band, and it's going to be a pretty hard blow for bluegrass musicians if we don't have that band, and, you know, we really need you to come and all that. Yeah. So I said, well, okay. And I called Dallas Wayne, who had been in the band, and I had played a lot of shows with Slavik Hanslik, a great guitar player from Czech Republic, who lived over here in the States for quite a while. And got a guy named Ali O'Shea, who is a great fiddle player and had you know, taking the Pump Boys and Dinette show from Chicago down to Branson, and he's played, you know, with all the a lot of the country guys, the hat band, so to speak, and he's best buds with Jim Lauderdale and plays with him a lot. So anyhow, Ali went over on fiddle and Dallas on bass and Slavik on guitar and myself, and we went over and did a tour, and it was so successful we went back as that band again and released a CD on a Czech label. We were called Chow Dogs. It was for our last name, Cahill, Hanslick, O'Shea, Wayne, mm-hmm. and Dallas, Ali, Greg, and Slavik. So we were the Chow Dogs over there. So
yeah.
That recording is still floating around, and we keep talking about maybe going over again sometime like that. But mm-hmm. that would have been in, you know, right around, God, it was right around when the war of 2004, actually. So that's pretty much my life, right? Specialty and with I can't believe I'm talking so much. Sorry.
No. It's totally fine. I know your time's a little bit limited. I did want to ask you a couple of, you know, if we can just.
Sure. Yeah, we got time.
A couple more topics. I wanted to ask you about, you know, your involvement in IBMA through the years. I know you you were the president for a while.
Yeah. I had written Dan Hayes back in the 80s. I can't even remember what the issue was, but I was a disgruntled member saying, yeah. Man, this, what the heck, you know, this, I don't, this isn't right, you know, and blah, blah, blah. And he was like, well, I really respect your opinion and all that. Thank you. And glad you're an active member and that you care, you know. I said, great. And then about 3 weeks later, I got this invitation to run for the board.
Yeah.
So I did, and I didn't make it. I think the first time I didn't make it. And then I got another invitation, I don't know, the next 6 months later. And I said, well, I'll put my hat in the ring one more time. And then I got elected to the board. So I ended up being on the board for about 12 years, actually, altogether.
Mm-hmm.
And spent 3 of those years as the vice chair and then 4 years as the chair. And, you know, that was a lot of hard work. It's a volunteer board, and you got to respect those folks on the board because, boy, it takes a lot of time to really get things hammered out and make sure that everybody's getting what they need, and they come up with new programs that help the membership and so on. And I was real happy because we were able to negotiate for that health care.
Uh-huh.
You know, that was hard to do because every state has different rules and laws. And the Bridgestone folks, I can't remember the name of them now, but the folks who decided that they would take it on and underwrite it, that was a huge help that now you can get some kind of coverage through the IBMA as a member. And I think that was my biggest thing. And of course, education. We started the foundation for bluegrass music during my tenure as the chair, and where now you could, they can receive donations as a 501c3,
mm-hmm.
and then move the bluegrass in the schools program there, so we could implement it and have, you know, make it available for folks to bring bands or people into the schools and so on.
Well, that was the other topic I wanted to touch on. That's something you've been involved in for the years. You actually started a program with the band, right?
I did. It was in the 1980s, mm-hmm. Back even when Chris Jones was still in the band. You know, I had some teacher friends who said, you know, when you're in town, why don't you just come in, just show the kids a banjo, you know, just play the banjo sometime. So I said, okay. And I did. And the kids just really liked it. I did that a couple times, and then of course one teacher would tell another, and then they'd say, hey, come in and just tell us a little about the music. And so I did. And a couple times Chris went with me playing guitar. And it was clear that there was interest both by the teachers and the kids, because a lot of them had not heard anything like that, and a lot of them had not seen a banjo.
Right.
So I went to the library, which we used to do before the internet, you know.
Yeah, it was this building that you go to with books and.
Yeah, something real different, you know. And I researched it and made a little study guide for teachers, just a couple, 3 pages. and put that together, and then just started saying, okay, you know, we can, maybe I'll bring the band in, and we tried that, and that worked out even better than, you know, people seeing a big old stand-up bass, you know, the kids be like, wow, that's really cool, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
And and a mandolin, a lot of kids had never seen a mandolin. They just, that was something totally new. So, and when we were doing that, then, like when Josh was in the band, he also played some fiddle, so we'd have the five main bluegrass instruments, and it just went over really well. So I just kept refining this little study guide. And back then in the 90s, the 80s and the 90s, a lot of the states had touring rosters. You could sign up and submit all your work. And they would, if they put you on the touring roster for the state, then the state would contribute money towards these programs you would do in the schools. So we were on the touring rosters for a few different states, Illinois included. And that was really helpful because then we could go in and spend a few days in some of the schools, you know, and they would get support money. So, and that sort of morphed into the Bluegrass in the Schools program. Tim Stafford was working on that and asked me to come in on that committee. And then Nancy Cardwell and I worked on that Discover Bluegrass. Actually, it started out as a just a study guide. And then that morphed into doing the video that we did with many different folks. Sierra was part of that, doing you know, different segments on the instruments or on the singing or on the playing together or whatever. And then that morphed into the revised edition and DVD and so on for the IBMA. So I think it's a good thing, you know, and I hope that somewhere along the line there'll be some more money allocated back for education, you know, to, because it was, you know, it was sort of like a historical music lesson where you'd learn the history of the music as well as see and hear all these instruments, you know. It's pretty cool, I have to say.
Yeah.
And what gets me now is, you know, years later, I mean, I can't tell you how many times, you know, somebody who's maybe in their 20s or even now close to 30 and they're 3 feet taller than me saying, I first saw the banjo when I was 8 years old and you came to our school. I'm like, oh my gosh. You know, not to make me feel like an old guy or anything, but
but it's probably rewarding to hear that.
It is that you know, these things, you have an impact, you know, and sometimes you don't think about it that way. But sure enough, it does seem to make a difference. And I applaud all the bands that, you know, you're clearly not doing it for money because you never made a lot of money doing that. And I think it's just great when you go and introduce the young folks or support them or, you know, try to and really encourage them to play this music, you know.
It takes young people learning it to carry it forward, obviously. Tell everybody, let's talk about gear for just a second. Like, what's the banjo you play these days?
Yeah. Well, I've been touring, you know, back when we were doing some of the school programs, actually in Pontiac, Michigan, and this got to be 20, 25 years ago. My buddy Tom Lang had set it up and took us to this little diner in Pontiac, Michigan, because the waitress was really funny. And next door, oh, God, this was in the 90s when Bobby Burns was in the band, because we walked out of the diner, we had a couple minutes, and next door was a pawn shop, and walked in, and there was this Kel Croydon banjo hanging there on the wall. And I never dreamed, I didn't frequent pawn shops that much at all.
Uh-huh.
I never dreamed I would be a guy who picked up a banjo in a pawn shop like that. But it was an original, most folks think it's a 35 Kel Croydon. And so I took it to Frank Neat, and he made a neck for it. And I tried a couple tone rings. I ended up with a Yates tone. I wasn't going to put a tone ring in it, but then I thought, well, I need to be louder sometimes if the sound isn't so good at a festival, you know.
Uh-huh.
So I have a Yates tone ring in it, and I just think it sounds great. I've been traveling with that lately. I actually have an old 3, a 34-3, mm-hmm. that Frank Neat also made the neck for. And it's got a Burlile tone ring in it, and it sounds great. That's the one I recorded I do a lot of the recording with that. The Long I Ride CD, I did all the recording. I think even, Country Boy, the John Denver one. But I travel with it some, but I get nervous about flying with it.
Yeah.
And the Kel Croydon, really, I get nervous about that too, but it did get broken once and got fixed, so I know it's okay that it'll survive, you know. So I've prided it pretty much between those two. And I have a Huber. I have a Huber banjo that I really like. And I travel with that sometimes. It's a Lexington model, except it's not gold-plated. And I put a mahogany neck on. The Lexington is a maple model. So those three, and I use GHS strings. I kind of go between the custom lights, which are 10, 11, 12 and a half, 20, 10, mm-hmm. and the J.D. Crow stage set, which is 9 and a half, 11, 12, 20, 10. I mean, 29 and a half. So
yeah.
I just keep bouncing between them for strings. And I have some old National finger picks that I've used forever and have come across some over the years. So I have a few replacement sets for as long as I'll be playing, I'm sure. And I've been using the Blue Chip thumb pick. I used to use the Golden Gates,
mm-hmm.
and I love them. And then there's this guy in England. We'd go over there all the time, and he'd go to the flea markets and pick up the old brushes and mirrors and take the turquoise off the back. And he was a master of putting those onto the Golden Gates. So I was using those, but the Blue Chip came out, and man, it just has that clear, clean tone, and you don't have to polish it like you did the turquoise, and it just sounds great, you know. And at first, it took me a while to get used to it. In fact, the first time I used it, it flew off my thumb because it kind of got that different angle to it.
Uh-huh.
But I knew JD was using it, and we were playing Bean Blossom one year, and I went in the back, heard him pick, and he was coming on right after us, and I said, "Hey, can I see your right hand?" And he looked at me like, "What?" I just wanted to see if he was really using it, and he was. And then he told me it took him, he had to get used to it a little bit too. But he said I would never use anything else because of that tone. So
mm-hmm.
that
mm-hmm.
sold me on it. And then it does. I don't know what the metal picks. It just gives you such an even tone. That's what I've been using for me anyway. It sounds good.
Yeah, I just saw Matt a couple weeks back at Gray Fox, and I've not really tried those, but I need to. I need to get one from him and give him a shot.
Yeah, give it a whirl. I mean, I don't know. It's just it sort of glides over the string. You know, you don't have to hit the string hard or anything. It's there's no resistance, and it's a real clean sound. And boy, it takes forever to wear them down. I've been using the same one for about a year and a half now, and it's barely showing that it's been used. You know.
Mm-hmm.
So it lasts.
Well, man, you've been generous with your time. I appreciate you agreeing to do this. And before we wrap things up, tell everybody where they can find your music. And you have instructional material too, right?
I do. I have a few DVDs that I did. They actually, years ago, they were videos first. But for beginning banjo and then more advanced. And have a couple tab books. There's a tab book where my buddy Russell Soiler from Canada tabbed out every note I played on that Country Boy recording, which was I don't know how he does it, but he's great. He's done it for some of the J.D. Crow recordings and Jason Davis and Ron Stewart and all that. But anyway, I have one that has everything I played on the Country Boy recording tabbed in that book, and then I have another book I just came out with Michael Miles for Hal Leonard. It's called 50 Songs You Should Know on the Banjo, and 25 are clawhammer, 25 are three-finger style. And there's some of the good old tunes, but there's a few like swingy things and some different stuff in that tab book. And then all the recordings, it's all at specialc.com. You can find it all on that website. And, of course, you can find a lot of our band recordings on the Compass website, compassrecords.com, and on Amazon or any of the usual outlets. You know, they're there.
Mm-hmm. And I guess you're on Facebook and Twitter. And
Oh, yeah. Thanks. Not Twitter, but we're Facebook and Instagram and all that. Yeah, all Special right. C. It's all under Special C.
All right. So everybody can go like their Facebook page and check them out on Instagram and go order some music.
That'd be great. Yeah, a lot of YouTube stuff, too. So
yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks a lot, man.
Well, thank you for spending all the time. I just babbled. I'm sorry. I just got going there and told you the history of the world here. So
no, it's great. It's great.
But edit as you seem necessary, for sure. And yeah, thank you for thinking of me. I sure appreciate it, Justin. No kidding. That's great of you. Thanks for talking to me.
Yeah, man. No problem at all. And maybe at some point we'll do it again and just talk more about the business side and what all is going on, you know, with that these days and everything. So
yeah, that'd be interesting. Yeah, love to talk to you about it too, from what how you see it, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hey, I hope you enjoyed this episode. Thanks a lot for hitting the download button or the play button and listening to this show. And I invite you to come back next time. I've got Junior Williams from the band Newtown. Talk about their new record and what's going on with the band and all that sort of good stuff. And until next time, thanks for listening to the Cosmoses podcast.